Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We're your host for this weekend edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, where, man, we just continue to cover these pretty wild markets and markets that continue to drift lower. And this week, it was another big week with the Fed meeting, also a surprise ECB meeting, but again, the Fed and their 75 basis point hike, again, just showed investors, it seems like at least right now, how serious the Fed is to try to get inflation under control. And they seem to be okay with markets continuing to correct. And that's what we saw after that statement. We are kicking off the show in the first few segments with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. This is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail or individual side, Rick writes in the No Trader, as well as a piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the overall goal to beat the S&P. And we've heard from Rick recently that, boy, oh boy, has he ever been beating that S&P. Rick, let's start off broadly, though, with the Fed decision, the Fed meeting this week where the Fed hiked rates by 75 basis points. It didn't seem like that hike, that 75 basis points, was on the table until after that most recent inflation number, which happened two Fridays ago. And then the markets, boy, oh boy, did we see market interest rates scream higher. Rick, first and foremost, what was your takeaway from that 75 basis point hike by the Fed?
Well, hi, Corey, and hi, Shad. I think that the Fed was forced to do 75. It was probably not their initial intent, but after that number came out and the way Fed fund futures were priced, I think they had no choice but to do 75. If they had done the 50 that had been the consensus number up until a few days before the announcement, I think they would have been looked at as being very weak and still very behind the curve of what needed to be done. So I think they were pretty much forced to do the 75 bip hike.
Well, Rick, when you look at, you know, the trajectory that they're on to continue doing these rate hikes, there's been some messaging that came out recently. They ultimately want to get the Fed funds rate up. They say between a target of 3-4%. We've seen a lot of market turbulence, though, just on these first three hikes. So do you think that it's actually something where they're going to ignore even more market weakness just to temper the demand side of the equation since they can't really affect supply and just go ahead and plow forward with it? Or is there potentially a breaking point where if the market makes enough noise, they just may have to pause and at least wait to see what they've done, what effects it has?
I think for the time being, you have to look at it that the Fed is not going to care a heck of a lot about what happens to the stock market. They have a mandate to have inflation under control, and they have lost control of that issue. And that is one of two main mandates they have. I think to save face, they're going to have to do what they need to in order to rein in inflation, which is going to mean significantly higher rates over time, potentially quite a bit of it this year. And whatever happens to the stock market happens to the stock market. I think they're going to be less concerned now about that particular asset pricing and have to do what they have to do. Look, they let things get out of control for years. They eased when easing was not needed. Their balance sheet is significant. They need to unwind that and they need to get inflation under control. So Chairman Powell just got elected to another 4 years. He really needs to kind of save face. And I think that is going to be their primary goal now. And they fueled the stock market rally for years. They may need to be the same reason that the stock market comes off.
So Rick, do you think inflation could significantly come down in, say, the next 3 to 6 months until the end of the year with all these rate hikes when you combine the slowdown in the economy? Sentiment is also getting lower. Consumers are starting to run out of money here. Could inflation correct almost just as fast as it went up?
I don't think it'll correct as fast as it went up, but I think that the slowdown that's likely to occur, both from ridiculously high food prices and over $5 at the pump gas prices, there is and will be a continued slowdown in people's discretionary spending. One of my daughters lives in Tampa, Florida, and she works in Bradenton, Florida, which is a 50-mile drive in each direction each day. And it's all highway driving, but it's costing her a chunk of money to get to and from work each week. And, you know, that's going to be something where her salary hasn't been upped because of that huge increase in you know, her expenditure to get to work. She'll have to do with less elsewhere. And I think that's just a very typical example of the high price of oil and driving your car. I think people are going to stop and think now about when they make trips, or can they combine trips, and am I going to take that, you know, hour drive to take a nice nature walk on the weekend somewhere? I think a lot of that becomes very conscious in people's minds now, and that in and of itself will help decrease demand as we potentially roll towards a recession. Go to the supermarket and see what you're paying for, you know, prices of things. It's gotten crazy, and it's going to get a heck of a lot worse. So I think the inflationary pressures when it comes to food prices are not close to being at the highs. So to answer your question, yes, we could see a tempering of inflation over the next 6 months simply because the demand picture decreases. Nonetheless, the inflationary numbers will still be well above the target that the Fed has set, and it's still going to impact people's spending habits.
Yeah, remember when the Fed only had a 2% target, and now they've shot way past that. So even if inflation was to temper down, Rick, to your point, prices are already so high just from the last 2 years of what's happened that even if we have a slower rate of inflation, it'd still be on much higher prices, and they're probably not going back to where they were pre-pandemic. So it's just going to be another force people deal with, and the wage increases that people have gotten at their employment are not keeping up with these price increases. So do you think there's a point where, to your to the point about the food cost and energy cost eating into discretionary spending, that this may hit the balance sheets of companies in a big way, and we may start seeing the consumers, which have so far been pretty strong, not be there for retail, for consumer discretionary, for some of those sectors? You know, are you worried about some of those sectors maybe having bad earnings reports in the next two quarters?
Well, look, when I think that the earnings revisions numbers are coming down on the street, and yet the market has not come down as much as the earnings revisions are coming down, which leads me to believe that we're not done going down. Now, we can get a bounce at any time. We can't really judge today and tomorrow's price action as necessarily a reaction to what the Fed did, because tomorrow's a triple witch, or even we'll say a quadruple witch. So if you look at open interest in like spider at the money and like the at the money puts, there's huge open interest. I saw this morning the 370s, and of course now we're trading lower than that in the spiders. We're in the upper 360s, but the 370s had something like 80,000 puts that expire tomorrow. And another maybe close to, I think, 60 or 80,000 at the 350 level. I mean, there's huge downside hedging that's going on. And the people on the other side of it, you know, are now dealing with the fact that they've got huge open interest in puts that are going, as of right now, are priced against them. So I'm not going to look at today and tomorrow's price action necessarily as being the true response to the Fed. And I think that at any time, certainly given how oversold the market is, we could always see a bounce. But I've said it all year. I've said it to you guys before. We are minimally in a two-way trading market as compared to what we've seen in the past, which was purely buy the dips. You didn't have to worry about selling. It was just buy the dips. We are in a two-way market where you also need to sell rallies. And the question is, are we even going to see rallies to sell into? You know, we had one a few weeks ago, and it stopped near 4150, which is in the S&P, which is kind of where we broke down from. So it was very natural and obvious place that the market stopped and has now made new lows. There are always certain targets. So I said, I think it was last month's show with you guys, and maybe even the month before, I've had a 3617 downside target for the S&P this year. I can't say that's going to be the bottom, but that's what, you know, we've been playing for and thinking was likely going to happen for months already. Where we're trading now, we're only 60 points or so away from it, which is only a little more than 1%. So we're getting closer to some targets, and it doesn't mean it has to stop there. But given the bull market that's been in place for years, and of course you had the COVID sell-off, but then if you look at what the market did since the COVID bottom, which if I remember correctly, I think it was something like 2,200 in the S&P. So we more than doubled the price of the S&P since March of 2020. Even if the market came off 30% this year and gave back last year's gains, we're still up dramatically in the last couple of years, and certainly since the Fed started their easy money back in 2009 when the S&P got to, what was it, 667. This is part of the normal give and take of what happens in markets. And the thing is, a lot of people haven't really lived through bear markets before and how they trade. And the COVID market was such a quick thing. We sold off, a month and a half. We went from virtually, if I remember correctly, where all-time highs to, that bottom in March. It was a dramatic sell-off from an exogenous event that was extremely fast. This is a more steady decline. It's been happening. Just look at your charts since January 1st, where we're pretty much straight down with a couple of trading bounces along the way. And there's nothing yet to indicate that any of the up moves we get now are going to be anything more than trading bounces. And honestly, I hope we get some to still lighten up.
Yeah, it's a pretty nasty market. And again, to your point, a lot of investors haven't lived through a true bear market. Some of the most recent bear markets have come so quickly and so sharply that the rebounds have almost mirrored that and been very quick and sharp. Rick, how do you compare this time to bear markets in the past? Give everybody some context on how you think this is similar to other bear markets, in a way kind of ignoring some of these, in a way, flash crashes that we've had.
Right. Well, so one of the things, and I'm glad you just even used the term bear markets, because I do a lot of interviews, and of course I have my The No Trader podcast every week. One of the things that I've made a big point of is that I really think the press has done a disservice to the public by only, earlier this week, finally saying that we had a bear market, because they're so stuck on this 20% number for the S&P. So we got 19.9% and had a bounce, and they go, oh, the market's not in a bear market. It has traded like a bear market all year. And to first, who is the intended audience when you say now we're in a bear market? Is that supposed to have, now the average Joe should consider selling because we've sold off 20% from a high? I mean, to me, it's utter foolish. It's just bad journalism, and I'm really disappointed, and I see it across the scope of it's the major newspapers, the major television channels that people watch that report on the news are saying, now we're finally in a bear market. Well, hello, what do you think we've been doing all year? Market has traded like that all year. The NASDAQ has been like that for over a year. It's just kind of silly. So now when you talk about, what do we do with a bear market? Is this different than others? Well, the last real bear market, we'll say, was from the peak in 2007 to the bottom in March of 2009. And that was the great financial crisis. And this, we're starting to see similarities in the sense of the severe declines, the minimal bounces, the fact that there's some real structural issues. And in this case, instead of it being mortgages blowing up, it's really the fact that the Fed has lost control over the inflation picture and has forced rates higher. Remember, it's just a short time ago, within, I guess, last year and a half, give or take, that there was no other place to put your money but the stock market. Interest rates were darn close to zero, right? The U.S. 10-year got down to 40 basis points. The short, with the 3-month treasuries were, 15 bips or something like that. I mean, there was nowhere to put your money except the stock market. And then the Fed loses the battle against inflation, which they never seemed to care about until it was already a bad situation. And now they force rates higher, which means that bonds that you owned have lost considerable price value. So you've had huge capital losses on your bonds. The stocks are now down 20 plus percent in S&P terms, 30 plus percent in NASDAQ terms. Bitcoin has fallen, 60%, something like that. The only thing that's kind of held up is gold. And so gold has been a good hedge. You're not making money with gold, but you're not losing money. And in that respect, it's the hedge that you'd want it to be. In the very simple terms, is you're not losing money by being in gold when all these other asset classes are going down. So the typical risk on assets have now kind of fallen apart, and gold has at least held steady. And it would have done much better if it wasn't for the dollar flying. But the dollar's on multi-year highs.
That's a good point, Rick, about the gold just being a good hedge and not losing money when everything else is crashing, which is kind of its role in one's portfolio as a sort of insurance product, and even in the face of a flying dollar. But I guess one of the points you just made was, I think, right on, that the financial media is usually late to the game. By the time they plant their flag and declare it a bear market, it's been pretty obvious for many, many months. I mean, really, since the third quarter and fourth quarter of last year, we started seeing certain sectors begin their rollover, and that's only continued. So I'm curious, Rick, as someone that does the 7-Eleven report, and you're able to continue to rotate into the sectors that are going to outperform the other 11 as a general rule of thumb, what do you look for? I mean, I know you look at behavioral psychology, quantitative analysis, technical analysis, the fundamental backdrop, but how can investors take a page out of your book, Rick, and get into these trends or position their portfolio before the mainstream media announces it?
Well, so part of it is the anticipation. You've got to be able to anticipate what happens. Think about it was right Wayne Gretzky who said something like, "I go to where the puck is going to be, not where it is." Right. So he was great because he can anticipate where the puck was going to go to. I think part of what we do at In the Know Trader and is different than most is we're better than most at anticipating the changes that are going to take place from a sector point of view before it's obvious to everyone else. Case in point, let's say last summer we went overweight financials when nobody wanted to touch them. We went overweight in August energy, and energy was near its 20-year historical all-time low versus the S&P. But the models we use, including, as you said, quant, technical, behavioral strategy, we combine them all to anticipate where the changes are going to be before something's moved 20%. And then everybody goes, oh, I guess it's no longer a bear market. It must be a bull market. And it's in that respect, in the month of May, the 7-Eleven report outperform. In fact, it had its best month in the 22-month history that since we started it in August of 2020. It outperformed the S&P by 165 basis points just in the month of May alone. Year to date, we're outperforming by 344 basis points through May 31st. For our fiscal year, we're up by 4.4%, which started August of last summer. And in the 22 months since we started 7-Eleven, we've outperformed by 698 basis points. So basically 7% in less than 2 years. simply by being able to anticipate better than most the shifts in the sectors before they're obvious. And the what can an investor do? Well, they could subscribe to the 7-Eleven report. It's very inexpensive. It comes out once a month on the last day of the month to give you new allocations for the next month. And frankly, I give this away for like ridiculously low price. It's $87 a month if you go month by month, and it's only the equivalent of $74 a month if you go and pay for the whole year up front. For less than $100 a month, you're getting access to some of the most sophisticated institutional models that exist to play this game. And, you know, I'm doing this over 40 years. I've been on the street. And I think that it's kind of a no-brainer to look at the markets the way we do and kind of get access to that. If you think about it, guys, being up the numbers like we are would put us in the top 10% of all money managers out there. So if this was an actual fund, we'd be in the elite, the top decile of all active money managers. So we don't manage your money. We're actually working on hopefully putting an ETF together, but that will be tracking the 7-Eleven. But until and if that comes out, I think it's not about tooting my horn. It is, we have the results to prove that what we do works, and it works consistently.
Good on you, Rick. Toot your own horn, because as well you should. You're beating the S&P in a time that a lot of people are having a lot of trouble and, quite frankly, just absolutely hating these markets. Let's dive into a couple sectors then, starting with Simply Energy. Oil's come off a little bit, but most recently had a breakout above 120 for crude. Still looking strong, but I think it is finally getting pulled down a little bit by the markets. Are you still invested in oil? What is your positioning there?
So we are invested in XLE. It is one of the seven of the 11 that we're in. And it has been our largest percentage overweight of any sector, which is part of how we've had such good returns. But literally on June 1st, we cut our exposure by 30%. So I'm still overweight XLE, but by a considerably less amount than we were coming into this month. And even though energy is still outperforming and the best performing sector, it's come well in relative terms. And again, we could kind of anticipate that this was the time and place that was likely to happen. And I can tell you that I do think the long-term relative bottom is in place in energy, and therefore I do not anticipate going less than a neutral to benchmark weighting going forward. In other words, I do not anticipate seeing myself have energy be an underweight going forward, but I did anticipate that, you know, this is an area that this could easily stall in relative performance terms. And a lot of people came to the game late. And that's why timing is such an important thing, too. And people say, oh, you can't time the markets. Well, it's part of what I've done for 40 years. It's how my name and reputation on the street is built on being one of the most prominent trading strategists on the street. And I take 40 years worth of experience to this. I'm not some 26-year-old quant who says, here's how you beat the market. 40 years of experience, having been a commodities floor trader for my first 12 years out of college, then on to Morgan Stanley in the commodities department, then Bloomberg came after me and I became the head of all of commodities, futures, and technical analysis at Bloomberg, and I actually designed their whole charting system. Then I went back to Morgan Stanley and was made chief market strategist. And a few roles since then, 40 years of experience takes you a long ways in having seen cycles and understanding markets and having been a trader and then on the sell side and then on the buy side gives me a unique perspective that a lot of people on the street don't have. And I think it it makes a huge difference in understanding how markets work and trade, because I've been in all three roles of trader, sell side, and buy side.
Well, Rick, let's talk about commodities, because you have such a vast experience there. Aside from energy, aside from oil and gas, what is your take on the rest of the commodity sector, be it the metals or the agricultural commodities, the soft commodities? What's your outlook?
So in general, I think we're still in a longer term up move. But right now, I think commodities are in a pullback phase. You'll have a chance, to get them lower. So I think the grains stall out a bit. I think the metals have already stalled. If anything, they're getting just a little bit of a safety bid. If the dollar comes off, and I think up between 104 and about 106.5 in the dollar index is not a bad place to be thinking of fading the dollar. Bullish consensus is quite high on the dollar. And, you know, we've hit multiple targets, and some people say we broke out, but to me, we haven't really officially broken out yet. So I don't mind looking for the dollar to potentially get a bit of a pullback here and possibly get back under 100. So with that, I think that in general, commodities are going to stall, but I like them longer term. I'm still looking. I'd be looking to be a buyer. Usually I tend to play the sector as a complete sector, using, you know, one of the popular ETFs like the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. The ticker on that is GSG. I think you get nice exposure to the, you know, broad market, broad exposure in the commodity sector there. It's not too heavily leaned towards the energy side the way like the CRB index is. So I think longer term, you still want to be in commodities. But if we get any slowdown here, I think you're going to see, you know, some of the demand just decrease. But in the big picture, when you look at the effects of the worldwide food shortage because of what's happened in the Ukraine, it's hard to see that, let's say, the basic grains like corn, wheat, and soybeans are going to get substantial pullbacks. But I do think near term, they certainly could pause. So I don't want to necessarily chase right now. I do like the sector longer term, though.
So, Rick, a little off topic here. I want to talk about the financial sector, because financial stocks or banks usually do better when rates are higher. Now, of course, this isn't just a story of rates being higher and everything else being okay. The economy's struggling. The markets are struggling. That's clearly weighing on the financial sector. Do you see this as a sector that when things settle at whatever time that may be and however much longer financials might move down, that they could bounce back because we should be in a higher interest rate environment?
Yeah, in general, yes. You know, and I think a lot of people have been caught off guard about how the financials have done in relative terms to the S&P, because it is a sector that traditionally, with higher rates, banks are going to make money on the float and the difference between borrowing short term and lending long term, and, you know, banks like higher interest rates. If you look at where the XLF is versus the S&P, you're kind of the same price you were a year ago, and yet interest rates are much, much higher. I think it was a crowded trade, and B, the speed at which rates moved higher is what has bothered people in the from being able to move that sector higher. You'd naturally think that the big move up in rates would quickly help the banks' balance sheets, but it's not. And the investors are concerned. The best thing that could happen for financials is slow movement higher. Not the fact that, you know, just a few weeks ago we were at 1.7% in the 10-year, and we got to, you know, 2.5 very quickly. We went from 1.8 to 2.5 very quickly. And I think it's the speed at which interest rates are changing that has the most concern for people right now. So I am overweight financials, not a large amount, but it is one of the sectors that I do have exposure in. So it's one of the seven, and it is a slight overweight. But it's, you know, if you look at this also topped out kind of early first quarter versus the S&P, and it's just kind of sitting there and can't advance. in relative terms. And I think it's the speed at which these rates have moved up.
Well, Rick, I'll open it up to you to any other sectors that you think may present the ability to have outsized gains compared to other sectors. And that maybe just means that they won't pull back as much as other sectors if there's a further washout. But are there any other sectors, you know, be it consumer staples, consumer discretionary, tech, anything else, the healthcare that has your attention right now?
I say if I had to pick one that has the most, my most attention, it's probably tech, because if rates, if we can get rates to stop going up at all and get a 50 bit pullback, I think tech is close to getting towards the bottom in relative terms. So I think when you look at valuations on tech and how much they've come in, I think tech presents itself with potential outperformance opportunity, but you don't want to keep seeing rates moving higher. And another thing that a lot of people are not aware of is that the game is going to look very different on July 1st when you have the Russell rebalance, because there's a very high likelihood that tech is going to get moved into the value area and energy is going to get moved into the growth area. So growth versus value is also going to take on a very different meaning in less than a month. I think people are going to need to, you know, there's going to be a lot of confusion over how to play that going forward, because the components are going to change dramatically.
Very interesting, Rick. We're going to wrap it up here. We've covered a lot, and I really like the broad comments early on about what the Fed is doing, how the markets are reacting, and again, realizing what type of a market this is, a bear market, and a bear market that hasn't just come with one or two shocks to the system. This is something that is pulling down pretty much every sector. And that's tough for investors to know what to do, because I don't think a lot of investors have faced this sort of a bear market. I honestly can't truly remember a bear market that I've been that active in that has been this orderly and still seems very early on in the pullback. Rick, thank you as always for your time. It's great chatting with you. And hey, keep crushing that S&P. I really love what you're doing with that 7-Eleven report. We'll post a link within the weekend show posting so you can find out more about Rick's products. Rick, again, thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, guys. It's a pleasure.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And we are wrapping up this weekend's edition with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. Now, Mike, it's been a few weeks since we last chatted, and undoubtedly what we need to chat about this week, again, following up on that first segment that we had with Rick Bensignor, deals with Fed policy. 75 basis point hike by the Fed. This started to become known by the markets early on in the week when more media sources and some of these so-called Fed insiders said that, look, the Fed is going to hike by 75 basis points, even though the last time they had a meeting, they said that they were not going to do that. They're going to stick to 50 basis points. Clearly, the inflation data has moved the needle for the Fed, because inflation just isn't coming down nearly as fast as they wanted. And quite frankly, it's not really coming down at all, at least in that last reading. Mike, your takeaway from that 75 basis point hike out of the Fed, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Fed really, especially recently, realized it was not just a little bit offsides, but way offsides when it comes to what the inflation numbers are showing. Especially even, Powell even alluded to this in his post-meeting comments, especially the most recent sort of inflation expectation figures, and what Main Street was really just glomming on to the rise in gas prices and everything else, and starting to, you know, when they have these surveys on what you expect inflation to do over the next year, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, all those numbers were going up. So I think what Jay Powell feared most is just, you know, public perception getting ahead of them, people therefore reacting in a rational way to, you know, expectations of a lot of inflation, asking for more you know, wage increases. Then you kind of get embedded in this wage price spiral like you had in the 70s. And that's what really had them spooked. So I think, excuse me, that's why I think you had the Fed, you know, already prepped to hike 50. But then this most recent data came out, especially the dismal CPI number, when they were in sort of this quiet period or that they typically have before the meeting. And that just made them, tipped them over the edge. So they had to, you know, kind of leak the news to the Wall Street Journal that they were going to do more, so Wall Street itself wouldn't panic. And sure enough, you got the 75 basis point hike that, you know, that was leaked and suggested. So it really does. I mean, you know, you listen to what Powell said, it really does come down to perceptions, expectations, and the Fed realizing, you know, we when you're this far off sides, there's no point in delaying the inevitable and kind of taking those measured steps you've taken in the past. This is a thing where you want to get on sides and get on sides fast. So by trying to front load more of these hikes, the Fed not only is being the most aggressive it's been since the mid-1990s in terms of the magnitude of this single hike, but also signaling more of that kind of action just to, again, not always be playing catch up, especially because they're so worried about public perception and, you know, that sort of inflation expectation getting embedded in the economy and in wage demands and things like that.
Yeah, Mike, it's going to be interesting to see what the next few Fed meetings entail. I mean, most people have priced in at least a 50 basis point hike for July, but now they may be recalculating with a 75 basis point, and then everybody's got their eyes on September to see, can they keep things moving? The Fed has messaged they would like to get their Fed funds rate, that their target is to get it up to a 3-4% rate. And obviously that may entail some more market weakness. They've already messaged that they're okay with some of the stock market weakness because they want to pull back the demand side. So what's your take? Can they actually get it up to a 3-4% Fed's fund rate without things breaking?
You know, you're already seeing some things, some parts of the economy and the markets break, notably. I mean, we've talked about it before, just all the sort of really far out on the risk spectrum, garbage tech companies, money losing IPOs, crypto, we've seen a lot of this sort of cycles equivalent of the dot-com cycles silliness. All of that part of the market has just gotten absolutely crushed, murdered, whatever like illusion you want to use there. And so we've already seen that happening, and that's been going on behind the scenes for a year now. It's only now starting to spread to the bigger parts of the market, the big tech companies. You're seeing housing really kind of hit a wall here in terms of demand, given how unaffordable housing prices had already gotten. And then you layer on top of that this surge in mortgage rates. I mean, a U.S. 30-year mortgage rate, it's kind of funny. I refinanced my loan back in November of last year when I kind of saw some things coming, and I decided, you know, I'm not going to keep waiting for lower rates. I'm going to lock in and refi now. I got 3.25, and right now you're talking about a no points 30-year rate in the low sixes. I mean, so essentially, just since November, the rate that a normal credit, you know, good credit borrower looking for a 30-year who has a nice down payment or you know, a chunk of equity, they're paying basically double in rate. And that has a huge impact on payment because the amount of loan you need, given the rise in housing prices, has gone up so much. So that sector is hitting a wall, and you're going to start to see more of that spread. I mean, we're getting to the point now where the layoffs, the firings, the, you know, companies starting to go broke that really didn't have any business being in business in the first place. That stuff is starting to happen. You're starting to get the economic fallout. So what I think we're going to see happen, and we're already seeing happen, you're going to start to see jobless claims tick up. You're going to start to see consumer spend. I mean, consumer sentiment was already terrible, right? Consumer sentiment is the worst we've seen in 40, 50 years, sometimes in the history of these sentiment surveys. And that even includes the depths of the great financial crisis, simply because Main Street's been hammered so hard by inflation. They've been hammered by housing unaffordability, by rising gas prices, whatever. So sentiment was already terrible. Now with government stimulus running out and with, you know, layoffs starting to rise, actual spending is going to start to roll over. And we saw that this week when we saw the, you know, worse than expected retail sales. I think that's what's going to start to happen now. So you roll it all together, the Fed is already kind of starting to break things. You're starting to see the economic fallout, and it stands to reason that what's likely to happen going forward is those big monthly job growth numbers are going to decelerate, spending's going to fall further, business failures are going to go up, and the Fed's going to realize, you know, we can't get to as high as we want simply because the economy can't handle it. So, you know, at what number is this hiking cycle going to stop? Obviously, it looks like it's going to go further than I expected before it started. But I still maintain that given the debt load in this economy, given wildly, unaffordable asset prices when it comes to things like housing, given what's already happening in the market and so on, and the wealth effect, I just don't think that they're going to get to the yields of yesteryear because, you know, everybody talks about how, well, inflation's as bad as it's been in 41 years, going back to the early 1980s. So why can't we end up with, you know, 15-16% funds rates and mortgage rates and all that? And I maintain that would be absolute economic Armageddon for the stock market, for the credit markets, for the housing market and so on. So I think things are going to break before we get there. But, you know, we'll see. I think the Fed definitely needs to get some relief on inflation. They need to get data showing inflation is peaking. And if they don't get it, they're going to keep on the warpath until they run us all off a cliff.
So, Mike, when you say the Fed is going to bring us to a breaking point or something breaks within the markets, I'm assuming, what does that mean to you? Can you expand on that? And when that happens, how quickly, in your eyes, does the Fed switch course?
Sure. Well, you already look at what's happening to things like the Japanese yen. I mean, it's not saying that's on everybody's radar screen. But the Japanese yen's been absolutely falling apart, collapsing. You know, it's fallen to multi-decade lows because the Bank of Japan is the only bank that's trying to hold the line on easy policy when the rest of the world's tightening. So, you know, those kinds of moves tend to cause tremors in the credit markets. People get caught offside. The crypto crash that we've seen, some of these, you know, these freeze ups and these companies that are, you know, apparently over leveraging crypto, all of a sudden, going out of business or finding themselves with no money in the kitty. Those are your systemic kind of breaking points that you're starting to see. That's why you're seeing things like the cost of credit insurance in the bond market, like credit default swaps and so on. The cost of insuring your investments against bond defaults is surging. In Europe, the difference in yield between riskier Italian bonds and less risky German bonds, that spread is widening out again. If you remember back in the early 2010s, and even before that, that's when we had that pigs crisis where all the peripheral European countries, the cost of borrowing was surging and, you know, the ECB had to step in and save that. So there's all these pressure points. There's all these things going on in different parts of the currency, stock and bond market that signify that the Fed is starting to break things. It hasn't broken anything badly enough that it's changed Powell's choice of policies. But ultimately, I don't see how we get out of this without another financial accident and a pretty significant one at that, given, you know, how much pressure we're talking about in terms of interest rates.
Well, Mike, you write the Safe Money Report. And so for investors today, should they be even trying to worry about returns? Should it be more about capital preservation? And what advice would you have for investors to navigate what seems like an ongoing tough market for the rest of the year?
Sure. I mean, you know, my sort of strategy for many, many months now has been to rotate out of the riskier stuff and rotate into the less risky stuff. In practical terms, that means selling things that were way overowned and too risky from a business standpoint, like technology stocks, and rotating into utilities, consumer staples, companies that make, you know, they're in boring businesses, but boring businesses that have recession resilience. And so that has tended to work, but even now we're starting to see the pressure get more broad-based and that even more defensive sectors are getting dragged down. So it's sort of been phase two of this where I've been raising cash. I've been, you know, hedging. I put the first inverse ETF into the model portfolio in years, a few weeks back. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, from a perspective of hedging or protection, those are the kinds of things you need to be doing if you're a more active trader or investor, or if you're trying to kind of give yourself bear market defense. Because let's be honest, I mean, even before this was quote unquote officially declared a bear market this week, when the S&P dropped 20% from its January peak, there's been wide segments of the market, like I said, that aren't just down 20% from their peak, they're getting absolutely destroyed. We're talking 50, 60, 70, 80% off their, you know, market bubble peak. So when you see that kind of stuff going on behind the scenes, it's a real red flag for the yellow flag for the overall market. So play defense, have more cash, hedge with inverse ETFs if you're a little bit more of a nimble trader, and, you know, continue to stick with things like gold. It's no secret or surprise or accident that gold, while it's not, you know, wrapping itself in glory and going up 10, 20, 30%, it is roughly unchanged to down a little bit depending on the day you check. And you know what? Being flat in gold, it sure as heck beats losing 30, 35% of your money in tech, which is what's happened so far in 2022.
So, Mike, is this broadly now a shorter's market? Do you think more shorts should be put on? Are you recommending that?
You know, this is an environment, I think, where honestly, you have to be doing the opposite of what you did during a bull market environment. In a bull market environment, when there's dips, you buy them for the next leg up to new highs. In a bear market, you know, when you get bear market rallies, and you do get them, you know, we had one a few weeks back, you want to be selling the rip. You know, instead of buying the dip, you're selling the rip. So that means if you're stuck with more stocks and ETFs than you think you want to own, use rallies to lighten up. It means if you are more aggressive, you're comfortable using shorts, put options, inverse ETFs. You know, there's a whole wide range of vehicles that can make money in a down market. That's what you do. You take advantage of rallies to short the rip or to add inverse type positions for the next leg down. Again, it's just, you got to flip that mentality, that psychology. I mean, what worked during a bull market, you know, kind of the exact opposite type of strategy is going to work during a bear market. And that's pretty much what we have.
Well, Mike, another topic we've discussed a few times over the last year or two has been being in dividend paying stocks, because at one point, at least that was better than sitting in cash because you were getting the dividend. But now even some of those sectors that were doing well, like utilities or like energy, are at the risk of rolling over harder, or some of the consumer staples that had nice yields. What's your take on the dividend paying stocks now? Are they really defensive if the underlying equity could still sell off hard?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you look at something like the utility sector, you know, not too long ago, it was up about 3 or 4% on the year. Now it's down about 6%. Down 6% isn't terrible, especially, you know, relative to a 30% loss in the tech sector. But it's not a positive return by any stretch. You look at consumer staples, same thing. They're down about 9%. Again, just under half as much as the S&P, but you're still losing money. It really depends on what kind of investor you are. If you're a super long-term type, you don't want to mess around with shorts, inverse ETFs, put options, whatever. You know, you can just sit in some of these hiding places or whatever you want to call them, these more protective type sectors, and you're going to lose money, but you're going to lose less, and you're going to, you know, preserve wealth on a relative basis like that. If you are more active, though, I mean, that's not what you should be doing if you're a trader or an investor with a short to intermediate term time frame. I mean, you know, I've said for quite some time now that the dot-com boom and bust is a good analog or good comparison, sort of mentally, if you're trying to like frame what's going on and think about it. What we've seen over the last year and a half and through present day is very similar to what happened back then. And if you go to back then, from the time the broad averages started rolling over, and that was in, you know, March of 2000, you know, some part, weaker parts of the market had already been falling apart since mid-year of the previous year. But, you know, it took what, two and a half years almost before the market hit a bottom. By that point, the NASDAQ had lost 80% of its value from its peak. Now, I don't know if we're going to lose 80%. That's a pretty nasty downside target. And I don't think that's going to be that bad this time. But just the overall situation in terms of the time it took and the relentless pressure, the nature of that, that's probably something to keep in mind. It takes quite some time to unwind bubbles like this. So I don't think, you know, your big cap tech, all that stuff that was overloved, overowned, overvalued, overpriced, whatever, you know, I think it's going to be in kind of a bear market for at least another year, really, and potentially more, because it's going to take time and price to unwind the mania that we had. So that kind of stuff, I absolutely wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole even now.
So I'm like, you're absolutely right that it's a very different environment for markets. 2022, probably going to go down in history for the end of that huge bull market, even considering that COVID washout that just lasted such a short period of time in the big picture. When this is all said and done, when the market finally bottoms, depending on what rate the Fed is at, and quite frankly, central banks around the world, how they manage to hike, do you see a different market as we come out of this? Is there going to be a loss of faith in central banks? Are they going to have less pull in the markets? Are investors finally going to be more active rather than simply being passive? Any of these, do you see a major change here for the financial market?
You know, I sure as heck hope so. I mean, let's be honest. This inflation forecasting failure and the policy associated with it is every bit as bad, if not worse, as that infamous garbage about from Bernanke and his predecessors about how the housing market wasn't a bubble and how even if it busted, it was going to be well contained and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I haven't seen a policy forecasting and policy action failure as bad as what we're seeing now since the peak and the, you know, the run up to the housing bubble. You can go even further back and, you know, talk about how Greenspan never even saw the dot-com bubble and bust coming. And it's been a series of these boom bust, bubble bust cycles. The Fed's been a primary contributor to it. They've escaped blameless a lot of times in the past, or with less blame than they probably should have. But, you know, fighting inflation and forecasting inflation and knowing what to do about inflation is supposed to be the Fed's expertise. It's literally written into the law that governs the Fed. So there's no way they can pass the buck on this one, you know, like they tried to do and like Bernanke tried to do and whitewash his problems with the housing bubble and say, oh, well, you know, we did what we could, but it's not our fault. You can't. How can you do that in a crisis driven by inflation? Because that is literally your mandate. So, yeah, I think if there's anything that should finally, for once and for all, get rid of this Fed worship and this sort of, you know, oh, don't blame the Fed, it's not really their fault garbage we heard after the housing bust, I don't see how the Fed finds its way out of this one. So, you know, I think that, yes, I do think this is going to lead to some kind of bigger, broader changes, depending on how bad the economic fallout is. And, you know, we'll see what happens over the next year or two.
Well, Mike, I guess just one other area we should probably discuss is the bond market and the radical change that we've seen. You know, after four decades of yields only going down and bonds only going up, there's been a sea change over the last 2 years where we got to that low point, August of 2020, and rates have continued to rocket higher. How do you think the dispersion between bond investors get back out into other markets as they flee bonds? Where will they go? Where will that capital rotate into?
You know, it's hard because this has been a market where almost everything or almost nothing has worked. You know, we had a market where the easy money was flowing, where almost everything was working, right? Now we're seeing the flip side of that. Bonds, you know, you talk about a 60-40 portfolio of stocks and bonds and how, you know, the 40 is supposed to help you when the 60 goes down. Well, you know, now 100% of your investments are going down if that's all you own. On a relative basis, gold, precious metals have done much better. But even there, it's not like, you know, gold's up 20% when the stock market's down 20%. It's at least just holding its own. Cash, you're losing money to inflation. I mean, you know, you put money in the bank that pays you 50 basis points and you lose, you know, 800 basis points to inflation above and beyond once you net out the yield in the inflation situation. So it is a tough environment. You even talk about real estate. Well, what's going to happen to real estate? If you invest in residential real estate, guess what? These rising rates are really going to hammer the value of those homes. And it's also going to, you know, unfortunately throw more people out on the streets. So you're going to have up, you know, on the rental side, you're going to have issues with tenants and so on. So it's tough. I think going forward, it's just, you know, at some point the Fed is just going to have to capitulate given all this downside pressure. And then that's going to sort of reset things. We're going to reset assets at a lower value. We'll reset housing to a lower value. I think, you know, we'll reset equity markets to a lower value where you can actually make money from things like dividends, and rates will stabilize. But between here and there, you know, you got to play defense. You got to have some hedges on. You got to have things like gold in your portfolio, and you got to have a lot more cash than you would. Because I mean, cash may lose money to inflation, but again, it beats losing money on the asset side, which is especially at much, much worse rates like you're seeing in things like tech. So defense is the name of the game.
Yeah, now is the time to be defensive. And to your point, if you're losing money in the market is still priced in U.S. dollars too, so it's a double whammy for you. So it's a tough market out there and a very different year. We're almost 6 months through it, and doesn't seem like we're going to get much relief for the next few months. Who knows, maybe the rest of this year and into 2023. Mike, thank you for your time. Everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. What an interesting week it was with the Fed hiking more than expected when you consider the expectations from about a week ago and the path of still more rate hikes. This bear market is seemingly going to be around for a while, and that's hitting pretty much all the stocks. Everybody, again, thanks for tuning in this weekend. Please keep in touch with Shad and I through email, fleck@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com. We love hearing from each and every one of you, and hey, we hope you all are taking a bit more of a defensive strategy right now because, hey, it's a tough market.